nutrition and its impact in our diet and its relationship to organic foods. I am very interested in this subject and have been for a long time, and personally have observed and measured differences. I am not a scientist in that regard, and I haven't done all the scientific studies that some of the research these gentlemen are going to speak about has been covering. But that said, both an intrinsic feeling that there is a impact in nutrition related to organic farming and a now scientific documentation of same is what we're talking about here. And I believe that it actually has a very, very important role in both discussion of agriculture and the future discussion and consumption trends of society. I actually believe that many people are driven in their decision-making processes by things like, is it a value? And that value process is one of the ways to measure that is nutrition. Another one is pesticide residues. Another one is freshness. Another one's flavor. And there are the trends in society as far as food consumption is towards more discriminating consumers. And I believe that nutrition will give us more good discriminating reasons for wanting to buy and eat organic foods. And I think from that is where we hope to organize this workshop. And that said, we have two presenters today to talk about this particular subject, and I'd like to introduce them. And first is Chuck Benbrook. Chuck Benbrook's from Idaho and a longtime researcher and involved in the dialogue about agriculture, both with the National Academy of Sciences and with numerous think tanks and universities and corporations and the government, and has been in lots of different parts of this, and I think will bring some perspective as well as what he's learned about nutrition, what's known and not known, what needs to be, etc. So first Chuck, and then Helga Hellberg from now the marketing person, I think director is the title, with CCOF, but also has an interest and knowledge in what's been learned and what needs to be learned and what's not learned in organics and related to nutrition. And in addition to this whole issue related to consumption, which I think will be driven, there's also the whole relationship of the nutritive value from a medical standpoint. And that's an area I hope we broach here, because I think it's actually one that is worthy of more consideration. So without further ado, I'd like Chuck, please, to come up, and he's going to give us his presentation about this issue. Chuck Benbrook.
Thanks, amigo. It's always a pleasure to have an opportunity to come to Asilomar and visit with all my friends in California agriculture. I'm going to speak about the impact of pesticide residues on food safety and human health, and I'm going to make the case that it's time for the organic community to sort of come out of the closet and start to openly discuss the benefits to certainly some segments of our population from seeking out organic food and reducing exposures to residues through the diet. The for many years, the organic community has shied away from making any overt food safety health claims because of concern about a lack of solid data and science to support those claims, recognizing that if the organic community got too far beyond the science that was available, it would trigger a well-organized, well-financed backlash like what we're seeing now against independent researchers and scientists that are working on GMO risks. But as a person that's worked in the area of food safety assessment and pesticide risk assessment for longer than I care to admit, I'm here today to tell you that the scientific case is now rock solid that purchasing and consuming organic food is a reliable way to substantially reduce pesticide risks, and that all of the toxicological evidence now suggests that for some segments of the population, this reduction in environmental risk load, if you will, is certainly needed to expand the concept of margin of safety, which is used pretty widely in regulatory risk assessment. The job of the EPA and the California Department of Pesticide Regulation is to try to broaden that margin of safety between the level of exposure that is happening to people either through the diet, through residues in water, or farm workers from being in and around sprayed fields. Want to expand that margin of safety between a level of exposure where there's evidence that a known adverse biological outcome is probable, and the level of exposure that's actually happening. And I'm going to share with you some of the recent information that shows that it's really important to do that, particularly for pregnant women, infants, and children through about age 12. This is kind of technical, and there's a lot of numbers I'm going to throw at you. So I've written my talk up in the form of a paper. It's fully referenced. We've got about a third of enough copies to cover everyone in the room. Karen's got them. She's got her hand up over there. It's also posted on the internet, and I will. It's kind of a long URL. If people want to be able to get it off the internet, it'll be posted on various listservs and other places. I think we all know from following consumer surveys that a major reason people seek out organic food is because they're concerned about pesticide residues in the diet. They're concerned about risk to their families and to themselves. Both the people that consume organic food and the general public, when they're surveyed, somewhere between two-thirds and three-quarters identify concern over pesticide residues in food as a major issue. We know that the consumer is focused on this. In the summer of 1996, Congress passed the Food Quality Protection Act, a major new piece of legislation that substantially changed the scientific standard against which pesticide residues in food were judged, and directed the Environmental Protection Agency to substantially heighten the focus on the unique risk to infants, children, and pregnant women from exposure to pesticides. The passage of the Food Quality Protection Act in 1996, those of you who have been following this for a while will recall that Congress passed that act largely in response to the 1993 report issued by the National Academy of Sciences on pesticides in the diets of infants and children. In a major report that was released during Rich Rominger's watch in USDA, and in fact, Rich was quoted 2 days before the report even came out, voicing the general support and acceptance by the administration and the recommendations of the report, and pledging that the USDA was going to move forward with everything it could do in the realm of integrated pest management, et cetera, to try to broaden these margins of safety. After the passage of this act and through the implementation since 1996, there's been an explosion of new information on both the residues that are actually in the food, their levels, the distribution, the maximums, and which parts of our population are being most heavily exposed. There's also been an explosion of research on the toxicology, the biological impacts of those exposures. There's important new information on both the exposure side of the equation and the toxicity side of the equation. I think probably the most clear-cut evidence is on the exposure side, where we have now several large government data sets that testing pesticide residues in food, where samples that are drawn from the marketplace, from retail stores or warehouses, if they are starting to record whether the samples are conventional or organic or grown with some other claim, like, for example, no detectable residue or pesticide-free or IPM grown. The USDA started collecting this data in the early 1990s through its pesticide data program. I was part of a team that included Brian Baker, the director of research at OMRI, my wife Karen, and Ned Groth, a senior analyst that worked for Consumers Union, and we analyzed 8 years of pesticide data program data, about 34,000 samples, if my memory serves me correctly, basically all of their data from 1994 to 98. We did 10 years of DPR, California Department of Food and Ag data. It was almost like 100,000 samples there. Of course, mostly conventional, but a large number of organic samples. And we also had a data set that Consumers Union had developed in about 1997 or 8, which focused on four foods, where buyers for Consumers Union went into stores around the country and bought conventional, IPM grown or labeled, and organic foods in four or five cities. And then CU paid to have very sensitive analytical work done on them. So what we did in this journal article that was published in the peer-reviewed journal Food Additives and Contaminants, which is kind of the most prestigious journal for food safety junkies, we published an article that documented the substantial differences between the frequency of residues in organic food compared to conventional and IPM-grown food, differences in the levels of residues, and also substantial differences in the presence of multiple residues. And in the paper, there are some tables that summarize the findings from the published article that came out in Food Additives and Contaminants, as well as some tables that Karen and I just generated a few days ago on newer data, just, you know, released in the last 2 years, the last 2 years of data from DPR. And I also found some very interesting data from Great Britain. The debate about biotechnology in Europe has really set off a very intense debate about the impact of farming systems and technology on food safety and food quality. And the reliance on pesticides and pesticide risk is a huge part of that debate in Europe. To provide some, you know, some raw data for that debate, the British government in 2001 started identifying a certain number of its samples and its routine residue testing as organic. We were able to get our hands on that raw data and analyze it. And actually, the comparison of the presence of residues in conventional food versus in organic food in the British data looks even better than the U.S. data in terms of how much cleaner organic is. There's about an eight to one difference in this British data set in terms of the percent of organic samples that test positive versus the conventional samples. There's a lot of sort of technical stuff that you have to get into to make these comparisons. I'll certainly be glad to share some of those details with you in the Q&A for those that want to get into it. But the basic message I want to give people: there are several hundred thousand samples now around the world being done every year testing pesticides in food. And most of the government data sets now are identifying organic as a subset. And this database is going to get very rich in a short amount of time, and it's going to show clearly that there, you know, residues do show up occasionally in organic food. They shouldn't be there, but they show up in a in a few percent, or 8%, or 10%, whereas in the conventional food it'll be 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 times more frequent. Plus, the multiple residues are very common in conventional food. The average apple in America has 3.4 pesticides on it, based on USDA's data. And that's clearly not the case with organic. So, pretty clear, robust message on the residue side. People who eat organic food are exposed to a much lower amount of pesticides through the diet. On the toxicity side, so the question then is, well, so what? The U.S. Department of Agriculture, in its public announcements on the organic program, has stated over and over again that organic food is no safer than conventional food. And this has been a pillar of the department's sort of public message as the National Organic Program has been unfolded. And the basis of that position that the Department of Agriculture has taken is that despite the presence of residues that are documented in these data sets, those residues do not pose any substantial or unacceptable risks. Therefore, conventional food is safe. Therefore, it doesn't matter that other food might be safer. Well, you know, I think that's getting to be an increasingly untenable position. I mean, I think we all can understand why the USDA, that's going to be part of their public message. But I think as consumers find out more about this information, and learn that there are some people in our population, particularly couples of childbearing age and families that have kids growing up, where a substantially greater margin of safety is clearly warranted to reduce the chance of developmental problems down the road for these kids as they grow up. Because what the toxicological sciences have uncovered in the last decade or so is that as human beings grow up from conception through birth and then during infancy and childhood, there are innumerable, incredibly complex and periods of development where a whole lot of things have to go exactly right for that child to grow up and be fully healthy and have an immune system that works completely, to have healthy neurological development and a full chance at a healthy life. And there is reams of science now that show that remarkably low levels of exposures to a number of chemicals, including several pesticides that show up in food fairly regularly, can block the normal developmental process by disrupting the natural role of hormones in regulating development. And this whole area of science is highly controversial. We don't have all the answers. They're just developing some of the assays to really link exposure to a given chemical at a particular time to a given outcome. Because one of the realities is that just like a farm, if you've got a sick field, it's almost never one thing, is it? It's a combination of a lot of things that have incrementally added together to make a field sick. And you can't fix a sick field by changing one management practice. You have to change a lot of things to restore health. Well, it's kind of the same way with the human organism as it develops. Probably, I want to share the results of one more study before turning over the podium to Helgi to talk about some of the nutritional stuff. This is as a pesticide science junkie, this is probably the most phenomenal study I've seen in my adult life. It's coming out in the journal Environmental Health Perspectives, which is the official journal of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. You know, it's a very highly regarded journal. It's been published in their online version as of October 31st, 2002. It hasn't shown up in the magazine. I just got my January issue and it's not in yet, but it'll probably be in either February or March. It was done by a team of researchers working at the School of Public Health at the University of Washington in Seattle. This is a team of researchers led by a guy named Richard Feinske, who's one of the top public health toxicologists, epidemiologists in the country. They've been one of the research teams doing lots of work funded by the EPA on exposures to toxic chemicals and impacts on health. And what the team did is they took two cohorts of preschool children ages 2 to 5, and they collected detailed dietary data for 3 days from the parents, and they found a cohort of kids that consumed predominantly an organic diet. It was 75% or more of the calories were from organic sources in this cohort of kids. And then they had a cohort of kids that ate almost no organic food and ate largely a conventional diet. And then they took urine samples from these children and tested the urine for metabolites of organophosphate insecticides, which are probably without a doubt the biggest problem from the perspective of food safety in the diet today. Residues of chlorpyrifos, and the parathions and dimethylate and malathion and acephate and the other OP insecticides. And lo and behold, they found that there was a 8.5-fold difference in the mean OP metabolite level in the urine of the kids eating the conventional diet compared to the organic diet. Now, these OPs go through your system fast. They don't last a long time. So 3 days is a legitimate period of time to make that comparison. And the last thing that they did, which, you know, is very intriguing, they used some calculations. When they find a certain level of metabolite in the urine of a kid, they can back calculate how much of the raw chemical that child consumed in the 24 hours or 48 hours before that urine sample was collected. And so they calculated what the metabolite levels said or suggested the intake levels were, and then they compared those intake levels to the levels that EPA is currently considers to be safe, you know, based on the, you know, where they're at in the process of implementing the Food Quality Protection Act. And this is their summary. Dose estimates generated from pesticide metabolite data suggest that organic diets can reduce children's exposure levels from above to below EPA's chronic reference doses, thereby shifting exposures from a range of uncertain risk to a range of negligible risk. Consumption of organic produce represents a relatively simple means for parents to reduce their children's exposure to pesticides. Now, that may not sound like a, you know, too clear cut, but for appearing in this a peer-reviewed journal of this stature, that is a ringing endorsement and a powerful statement. This unfortunately, this study has not gotten the national press attention that it should have. It got a little bit of coverage, but that may change next week. Next week, the Centers for Disease Control is releasing its second national survey of environmental toxicants in blood and urine. It's the CDC, about 5 years ago, started this program. They released the first set of results last year. They're releasing a bigger set of results this year. And it's going to have national data on these metabolites. And I'm betting that the CDC data next week will show that the levels in this study in these children will be comparable to the levels of 2 to 5 year olds all over the country. And, you know, if that's correct, then I think there'll be a real opportunity to use this paper to show how easy it would be for American agriculture to take this one risk concern largely off the table. And you know, while certainly organic is part of the solution to that, a lot of the good news about this is farmers that just get off sort of your hard pesticide program and do some good IPM without going all the way to organic, they can also get rid of these residues in food. And I think that's a hopefully a message that's going to help propel the EPA to take some stronger actions under the FQPA. I'll stop there. For those of you that want to get into this, all this data and these analytical methods in more detail, we've got a wealth of information on our website that we've done for CU on implementing the FQPA. We can get you that URL, and you can become experts in this yourself. Thanks a lot.
That's Chuck Benbrook. Great job, Chuck, summarizing a very important, and I got some questions for you. So when we, after Helga is finished talking, we'll be opening the floor up here and urging your dialogue. So Helga, are you ready for doing your presentation? And you're going to go right to a slide right now. And again, marketing director for CCOF, and also with an interest and done research in nutrition in organics. Okay. Thank you, buddy.
Titles. Yeah, thank you for having me. It's quite amazing. I grew up in Germany on a pretty sad diet and had my annual done, that was 27 or 28. And the doctor said, you look great, but whatever you're doing, if you keep doing it, maybe 5 years, that will be it. And I was 28. I had no oxygen left in my blood. I was working out. I was living a fairly healthy lifestyle, I thought. I had no red blood cells left, you know, the normal blood profile pretty much. And that was a shock. And I switched to organic food the next day. And within 2 years, honestly, the doctor could not believe how my health improved. So I'm living proof that changing your diet has a complete direct effect on your health. So with changing the diet, there came a whole lifestyle change. I moved to the States trying to find a healthier environment. I started to study nutrition. I'm a certified nutritionist now, and I ended up with CCOF, and now I'm here. So thank you very much for having me. It's quite exciting. I'm not sure if we can count on PG&E again. Oh, and it takes a sec for the light to come on. So I studied nutrition, and I based my final paper on two of the most comprehensive studies that are out there right now. There are a few newer ones, but the two most comprehensive ones are one from the Soil Association in England. It's called A Review of the Evidence, a great little book that you can order. I think it's like 10 pounds. And the other one is Virginia Worthington, which some of you might have reviewed already. She works on the East Coast. She's a PhD, and she works for the University of Baltimore. And she collected every study that has ever compared organic and non-organic, which ended up, I think, being over 1,200 comparisons. And of course, there are critics, as with every study. You can argue, you know, that the study is not conclusive. There are critics that say that most of the statistical findings, or some of them, are significantly statistically insignificant, which is true. She has samples in there or studies that have fewer than 8 comparisons, and after 9, it becomes statistically significant. But it clearly shows a trend, and the trend is enough for me to confirm my gut feeling, because in the past, if we look at history of human nature, 15 years after we developed this gut feeling that DDT is toxic, we were able to prove it, and it was finally banned. So what are we trying to do here is actually just confirm our gut feeling. So follow your intuition. Don't believe what they say. If they say other things than what I'm telling you today. So starting with an interesting statistic, this is actually a statistic that is based on governmental data. It says the last 60 years, this statistic just shows the last 30 years, all the basic minerals, calcium, magnesium, phosphorus, iron, have left U.S. soils. I will explain, or we will see later, things like selenium, not tested here. There are some areas in the U.S. where you cannot find selenium in our soil anymore, and I will correlate that to the current diseases, and it's actually quite shocking. But so just keep these numbers in mind. This is from 1992. All the ones that were tested were depleted, and it makes sense. Conventional farmers, or I should say non-organic farmers, only put back into the soil selenium, phosphorus, and potassium in synthetic forms. We know that synthetic substances, we don't know exactly what the absorption rates are, first of all. And secondly, there are billions of microorganisms in the soil that assist the soil in taking up nutrients. So if you have completely sterile soil and you only add three synthetic substances back into the soil, you will end up with mineral deficiency or nutrient deficiency in the soil. If it's not in the soil, we know that 16 elements are at least essential for plant health and 23 are essential for human health. So if it's not in the soil, it's not in the plants. If it's not in the plants, it's not in our diets. It's pretty simple. So Virginia Worthington's comparison is based on pretty much every vegetable that you can buy here in California. And we are very blessed here. I mean, we all know that, but it's amazing that we have access to organic produce pretty much year-round, although some organic apples still come from New Zealand, which brings up other issues, but that's okay. And the nutrients, the main nutrients tested, again, calcium, copper. You know what? I can't really see my own slides. I will come down. Is that okay? I always wanted to walk the stage here. It's amazing. Okay. So can you see over there? Thank you. And this is what she found. Every single mineral and nutrient, every single vitamin and mineral was higher in organic based on over 1,200 comparisons on average. And some of these minerals, for example, as I said, selenium, 372%, and even vitamin C, 27%. So that means if you eat three apples, organic apples a day, you have 100% higher vitamin C content in your system. That means if you want to compensate that with non-organic apples, you have to eat six, and then you end up with diarrhea because nobody can handle six apples. So in terms of body ratio, body weight, and food intake, which is critical in children because the food intake or nutrient intake per body weight is much more important. They take in much more food per body weight. This is extremely important to have the most nutrient-dense food you can possibly eat. So I took her studies further and said, okay, let's look at the deadly diseases in the U.S., the five most common or most deadly diseases in the U.S. are heart disease, cancer, stroke, diabetes, and osteoporosis. And although, of course, I admit that, for example, heart disease is caused by a number of reasons, if you smoke or if a lack of exercise, all that, it's interesting, if you just look at the nutrient part of heart disease, 50% of all death in the U.S., caused by disease are going back to heart disease. The most important minerals and vitamins are selenium, magnesium, and vitamin C. So in a diet or in vegetables completely depleted of selenium, it will not be in our produce, and if it's not in your diet, you will lose one essential mineral for heart health. Same is true, as I said, with vitamin C and magnesium, 29%. And these are really just the basic minerals. There are a whole variety. You know, 15 years ago, we thought that 19 elements are essential for human health. Now we know it's 23, and now scientists say this is all that we will ever find. what is this based on? We will find new things on a monthly basis. So this is really just what we know. There are millions of enzymatic reactions in the body, and we will talk about neurotoxicity later and endocrine disruption, that we don't even fully understand yet. So really just based on the minerals, it's already not sufficient. Same is true with cancer, second leading death-causing disease. 25%, that's actually a slide that's half a year old, it's 29% right now, or around 30% of all death. And it's kind of interesting, the people that deal with cancer, the non-holistic doctors, say that statistically the death rate of cancer has dropped. That's statistically, that's true. In total, that's not true, because all we do is we extend the total life. Now they can find cancer earlier in our bodies. So the total amount of lifetime of people that have cancer is longer. So statistically, deaths have dropped. But if you see total numbers, the cancer deaths have increased. We have no solution against cancer. That's the bitter truth. The most important minerals for cancer or to prevent cancer is our selenium, again, molybdenum, which you only need in micro amounts, but if it's not in the soil, you will not have it. And molybdenum assists potassium and selenium to be absorbed in the body. So if one of these elements, and these are just five or six elements out of hundreds of thousands that are out there, are not there, you will not be able to absorb it. Interestingly enough, the numbers we saw earlier indicated that the grade of mineral depletion in the soil is about adequate, is about equivalent to the increase of organic foods, to the higher nutrient content in organic foods. So although vitamin D and A have not been tested, it is most likely the case that even those vitamins and other minerals are depleted from non-organic soils and therefore higher in organic produce. So we can do this. I only picked the five. You get the idea. I want to move on. Stroke, calcium, magnesium, potassium, and diabetes, fourth leading death-causing disease. Chromium, vanadium, and manganese, again, micro amounts, but for example, chromium, 86% higher. If you eat a fast food diet where everything is depleted anyway, and no organic produce, I have no clue how you will get any of this, how you will get any minerals. And 50% of the food budget in US goes to fast food. So it just all presents one gigantic proof of that how we have done it for 50 years does obviously not work. Osteoporosis, vitamin D. Okay, so, and there we have the USDA government giving us two dietary guidelines. One is the RDA, recommended daily allowance, for example, for vitamin C. The same government says eat five a day. Well, if you eat five servings of non-organically grown produce based on these numbers, you end up with 70 milligrams of vitamin C in your diet. You will not meet the RDA for women nor for men. How can a government give out two dietary guidelines that don't work together? I thought that's interesting. If you eat organic, you will end up with 89 milligrams of vitamin C, so you will exceed the vitamin C RDA for women, and you will nearly make the one for men. RDAs are kind of funny anyway, because most of them are 80 years old, and they were intended to prevent scurvy or diseases that we had around the turn of the century, and I'm talking about the turn of the century, 1800 to 1900, not the one 2 years ago. So it's a little outdated maybe, but again, emphasis on organically grown produce to at least cover the bases. Chuck mentioned the pesticides. We will allow for questions, of course, later. We almost have 45 minutes or so for questions when I'm done. Neurotoxicity, endocrine system disruption. There are hundreds of thousands of chemicals in your body that steer and manipulate millions of molecular or cellular processes. So if one of these pesticides affect one hormone, and that's what endocrine system disruption is. You hear that all the time. Pesticides mimic estrogen. That's why they're called xenoestrogens, foreign estrogens. So whenever you take in a foreign estrogen, it messes up your hormone level in your body. That's endocrine system disruption. So your liver maybe gets inflamed or whatever you have, a cold, and your brain understands like cell phone noise when you don't have good reception. And it cannot send the right army, or I shouldn't use that word these days, but cannot send out the right response to combat whatever kind of disease you have in your body. So that's endocrine system disruption. Carcinogenicity and immunotoxicity, we can discuss a little later. So we have pesticides, which are the things that we don't want in our food or to grow the food. Then we have mineral depletion in soils, which leaves us with completely depleted food. And then we have issues of food production when we process food. The biggest ones are, of course, antibiotics. 70% of all antibiotics produced in the U.S. go straight to livestock feed. 70. Over two-thirds. And you end up without antibiotic resistance, which makes antibiotics pointless when you actually really need them. So all of these, of course, are prohibited in organic production. BSE, bovine spongiform encephalitis, it's another word for mad cow disease, which we all know. If you give grass-eating animals animal protein as their protein source, just like humans, animals that get a diet fat that has nothing to do with their natural diet or the way nature intended it, you will end up with sick and diseased animals. So, and let's clear about it, we do have mad cow disease in the U.S. too. We just call it different names. It's kind of funny. If you go to the Montana Fish and Game Department website, they warn hunters to touch the brain of deer because they have mad deer disease. It's a protein-based virus which you actually cannot kill, so all the ashes in England are kept in nuclear holding facilities because they cannot kill the protein. They tried solvents, they tried burning it. The protein is still active. We will have this maybe for a few thousand years, this virus around. So we do have mad cow disease in the U.S. We do have it in humans. It's called Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. So we can give it as many names as we have species, and then maybe we don't see the link, but it's all mad cow disease, unfortunately. Nitrates are cancer-causing in higher doses. And people say, yeah, there are naturally occurring nitrates too, and there are naturally occurring pesticides in plants, which are actually helpful for the body, that it's the response of the plant to combat pests in their natural environment. We are talking about nitrates from synthetic fertilizers. 45 million tons of synthetic fertilizers are applied on crops in U.S. alone every year. 45 million tons. So, as we saw earlier, nitrates levels in non-organic foods have been higher in every single study. GMOs, I think we know about that one. And then food additives and ingredients. And just a couple of slides about food additives. More than 3,000 are allowed in non-organic foods to prevent spoilage and to improve color, texture, flavor, and taste. Over 4 pounds per year per person in the U.S. gets ingested. Well, I eat mostly organic, and so are you, I assume. So somebody eats 8 pounds